But Charlotte said, I'm the director of microbiology and molecular diagnostics up in Rhode Island Hospital, Lifespan Hospitals in Brown University. So I'm going to focus a little bit more on the testing ends of things and, of course, give you some more repetitive statistics on trichomonas so we can really slam dunk this issue. This is just a beautiful slide of an electron micrograph that actually shows a vaginal epithelial cell, and this is trichomonas. Okay. So I sort of took a take off of Charlotte's title, part two, The Time Is Now. I think this is a pathogen I've actually been interested in about, 15 years, and been harping on a company to finally get moving with trying to create an FDA-cleared test that was a good test. So I think we're almost there. Charlotte talked about the disease background. I'm going to talk a little bit more about the pathogenesis. She did an excellent job on the clinical sequelae, also the prevalence and incidence, which is very hard to actually state definitively because we just don't have good studies. We don't have consistent test methodologies to compare. So again, when you look at different articles, it's very important to know, are you comparing apples to apples when you look at these? A bit about the current detection methods and sort of the benefits and disadvantages of them. And then really, where do those compare relative to amplification methods, which have now become standard, just like we did 10, 15 years ago with chlamydia and gonorrhea. And then again, considerations for future action, because what can we do with public health? So we joke about Trichomonas vaginalis getting no respect, which despite the fact that it's so prevalent, it just doesn't happen. And I apologize for the graphics. I have no idea how that happened. And I'm just not savvy enough to have gotten rid of it, but it's kind of cute. Okay. The key thing that I think is just amazed me when I was actually sort of reviewing facts about Trichomonas is that the draft genome sequence published a couple years ago actually shows it to be as large as the human genome. That is fascinating to me because what it tells me is that the pathogenesis that this organism has, or the ways it can elude immunology and all sorts of other things, has to be really significant. So it basically allows survival with adaptability plus. It's the most common treatable STI in the world, as Charlotte went through, so I'm not going to reiterate all of these. But it is more common than chlamydia, which we focus a lot on. Urethritis, vaginitis, cervicitis, proctitis are very common presentations. I think it's also fascinating that we really don't know what's happening. There is supposedly just a trophozoite form. It multiplies by longitudinal binary fission. There isn't a cystic stage, but there is evidence to show that there's some dormant type stage that we really don't know what that is. But clearly sexually transmitted disease. So the trich attaches to the epithelial cell, releases proteins which destroy the cell and elicits an intense local cellular immune response with inflammation that results in punctate mucosal hemorrhages. So that pathology in itself, similar to GC that we've talked about, you know, we're familiar with in the past, really allows a sort of break in that blood-brain barrier and allows the pathogenesis to be more significant. There's a tremendous lymphocyte recruitment, including CD4-positive cells, which may be part of the reason that HIV can gain access more quickly. It increases cervical HIV shedding because of that as well. Inflammation-related factors such as cytokines have been implicated in the pathology of prostate cancer actually as far back as 20 years ago. My former chairman at University of South Alabama actually published an article where they looked at that condition. Oops, sorry, going backwards. Trichomonas prefers an anaerobic environment of a pH of 6.0. The healthy vagina pH is 3.8 to 4.5. So what it does is it alters the normal vaginal flora so it can be happier. And it does this by phagocytizing other bacteria, which creates a more alkaline environment. It's really not a favorable environment in the semen at 7.2 or prostatic fluid. So it might be one of the reasons that we see it less commonly in men and more commonly in women. But to be perfectly honest, until we start really looking for this organism, we're not going to understand the pathogenesis. It's a fascinating possibility of everything we could talk about. Like, is bacterial vaginosis really due to the fact that maybe trichomonas is there? You know, there really are a lot of questions we cannot answer. One of the things, though, is that trichomonas contains these little structures called hydrogenosomes, which actually produce H2S gas. So this bubbling is what is one of the products of the organism itself. So itching, inflammation, frothy, bubbly discharge. Okay. Charlotte did talked about this. One of the things as that I look at, and often physicians will say in my setting, I'm in Rhode Island, and actually is a low prevalence incidence chlamydia GC state. And so many of the studies that are published to date are really in very high incidence or prevalence STI areas. But this is just sort of a synopsis of many of the different areas around the country, which Charlotte said geographically we see this very highly all over the place. But 38% New York drug users, Indiana adolescents 23%, Atlanta 13%, Birmingham 12%, New York 27%, San Francisco 28%. So the incidence is very high, but these are also in settings where the chlamydia and GC is also quite high. And I apologize, these names did not come in under, this is Munson, this is Males. But basically, again, in recent publications, we see that the range is very, very high. But in men, it's significantly lower. So this is all in women, and this is in men. But again, very high relative to chlamydia. So the overall range is anywhere from 3 to 58%. Unweighted average, 19.6%. You know, incidence, 12 to 58%. So you're going to get these incredible ranges because, again, we just don't know how well this is because the studies are not consistent, the diagnostic test methods are not consistent. And as Charlotte already mentioned, African-American are 1.5 to 10 times greater incidence than other racial ethnic groups. Drug use is highly associated, and exposure to a trichomonas-positive patient as well. So what about in low STI populations? Like, what's happening in my neck of the woods? So I actually wanted to look, and our Rhode Island population has a chlamydia prevalence of about 5% and GC of less than 1%. So this is just, we did 2 months of testing. We looked at 1 month, and then a little bit later we looked at another month. And this is just in patients who had a chlamydia and GC specimen submitted. So I have no idea if they're symptomatic, whatever. I just want to sort of see how much trich shows up in these patients that are showing up to get GC chlamydia testing. And this just shows you chlamydia, as we expect, shows up in that young age group. And trichomonas is rather prevalent there as well. But then we get this bump between 40 and 50 that really sort of popped up. And if we look in the AFFIRM group, so these are women that are coming in that are symptomatic, and they're getting the AFFIRM trichomonas gardnerella candida test performed, we look in this age group and we really see a significant bump of trichomonas in that older age group of 36 to 50. So this is quite unique relative to other STIs. And again, we don't know enough about the pathogenesis. Why is that? In men, as Charlotte said, we don't see it as commonly, but it is a little bit, again, in the older age group versus the younger age group. Prevalence anywhere from 6 to 25%. We saw we didn't even test men significantly in Rhode Island to know. STI clinics, if they're symptomatic, and if their patients were identified, you were more likely to identify it in men. But again, many high percentage are asymptomatic compared to GC chlamydia. And even in an STI clinic where the prevalence is very high, 70% of men were asymptomatic. And again, this is back in 1986. While natural history studies show men eliminate the infection, a proportion experience long-term asymptomatic infection and chronic inflammation, increasing the risk of developing prostate cancer and disease progression. So, you know, this has been pointed out for many years. Okay, current test methods. This is an approximation about what is currently done, but again, we're not exactly sure. Wet mount clearly is the most common methodology used. It's fairly simple and it's cheap. The BD AFFIRM test has made things a little bit more easy to test because we can look for a number of things in symptomatic people. The nucleic acid tests, or which are none are FDA cleared at this point, only about 2%. The OSIM, sort of the dipstick similar to group A strep, about 8%. And culture is still fairly prevalent for those places that look at it. So we've talked a little bit about wet mount. It requires a vaginal swab. You look for motile trichomonads. And again, you can see sort of a, maybe a flagella here, but unless these things are moving, you're not going to diagnose trichomonas from a wet mount. We actually allowed our outreach clients to send us trichomonas saline. And of course, they would never get to us within 2 hours. And so we had to put a disclaimer on every single wet mount that we got from outside the hospital saying that, you know, specimen may be compromised and results may not, you know, be fully accurate. And yet the chairman of our pathology department did not want to stop offering it. And, you know, it was before we could implement something a little bit better. Benefit-wise, it's quick, it's cheap, but not only sensitivity, but specificity, depending on who the reader is probably not particularly good. If I ask a medical student or a resident to look in a microscope, I'd be lucky if they could even focus on something, never mind actually look for a trichomonas. And Brownian movement with everything shaking, they'd call everything positive. The deficits, again, you need to do it within a few minutes or a couple hours. Experienced reader requires live organisms. And the sensitivity, again, ranges 36 to 77%, depending on all those factors, as well as what test method was it compared to. Now, the big piece that's kind of missing is that actually there are pathologists that read pap smears, and I don't do that. I'm a clinical pathologist in medicine. I don't sit under the microscope looking at slides, or I'd probably kill myself. And a lot of them will diagnose trichomonas based on a pap smear. And what they do is they do it in association with this sort of swirled up bacteria called Leptothrix. And yet it looks, here's one right here, trichomonas. But again, it looks like white cells. Well, a lot of pathologists now use automated readers for looking at pap smears. And that will not pick up trichomonas. So where that may have been picked up in some cases, that's not the case now. But there really aren't any good studies at looking at pap smears and their sensitivity or specificity. The rapid antigen test, you have to use it, a vaginal swab, and it has to be symptomatic patients. That's the only thing it's cleared for. It does not require live organisms, which is the best thing, because transit time is not an issue. The problem is that it really is a single test format, so in a symptomatic person who may have BV or Candida, you really can't differentiate that unless, you're doing some other quick Gram stain or looking for clue cells. It's actually rather expensive relative to the reimbursement that we get back for doing the test. So an antigen test is the least reimbursed. So let's say I get $18 back on the test, it costs me $12. It sort of is a little bit of a wash. The sensitivity, again, as Charlotte pointed out, if you compare it to culture, it's anywhere from 76 to 90, but compared to amplification methods, it drops even more. And again, these are only in symptomatic. Now, the AFFIRM VP3, which is a BD test, it is a molecular format, but it's hybridization. It's not amplification. And this looks for three organisms, Candida, Gardnerella, and Trichomonas. You have to use a vaginal swab. Again, it's only symptomatic females. So all of these, the men are sort of left out of the loop except for the wet mount. The benefits, again, it's a stable transport. It goes into its own specimen collection kit, so that is definitely a benefit. It's a subjective color endpoint. We do this in our lab right now. My techs hate doing this. It's very sloppy. They complain about it. It's kind of interesting. They've never complained about a test before, but they say it's messy. It's a very expensive test. Before I started doing HIV and HCV, this was the most expensive test that I'm doing in my lab. The sensitivity compared to nucleic amplification for TRIC is about 65%. The complaint I get at the physician end, especially the OBGYNs, is that it's too sensitive for Gardnerella vaginalis and or the diagnosis of bacterial vaginosis, and they feel that they're over-treating that. But to be honest, it's used. It's sort of, as one OBGYN told me, it's a necessary evil because they want to be able to do something more reliable than wet mount. And then culture, There's the in pouch, which is the most common. It's both a slide and a culture bag, so you can look at a wet mount immediately upon collection. And then it gets put in the incubator, the pouch, and it gets reviewed on days 1, 2, 3, 5, 7, or 1, 3, 5, 7, some time period for about a week. It's specific. Again, hopefully you have an experienced reader, but it's rather expensive, secondary not to the pouch itself, but the manual labor. So you go in every couple days, pull out, look at it. You'd need a person that's very good at this. The disadvantages, it's rather inconvenient for the collector and the lab because of the long period of time that you have to look at it. So the time to detection can be quite long, up to a week. Again, it's a single test. You're not pairing it with chlamydia and GC or other STIs. Again, as Charlotte said, tarnished standard in that when you compare it now to amplification, it really is coming out to be anywhere from 70 to 85% sensitive. So what options do we have for nucleic acid testing, which really seems to be where we would like to go? Roche has some in-house validated research use only assays that are being done at some centers. GenProbe currently has available analyte-specific reagents with general purpose reagents that you can use either on their direct tube sampling or the Tigris with Aptima. And there are about 20 U.S. sites currently using this, including LabCorp, which is a very large reference lab. So FDA clinical trials are currently in progress with the Tigris instrument, and so we're one of those sites. And then the Panther, which is a smaller instrument, an FDA trial is planned. So I'm finally encouraged that this is finally moving forward. But it's been a struggle to convince manufacturers to do this because it's not reportable yet. So, they've been sick of hearing people like Charlotte and I complaining about it. So I have to give them credit for moving forward with not really knowing what benefit we're going to get in the end here. So these are fully automated platforms. They're variable capacity. Obviously, the same specimen can be used. You get GC, chlamydia, and HPV for these tests is also in the pipeline as well. So urine, endocervical, urethra, and vaginal swabs, the trichomonas test is going to be with physician-collected vaginal swabs. But in our own lab, we've validated every specimen type possible, including pharyngeal, rectal, urine, everything, because that's just what we get. Okay, so how do things stack up? I wanted to show you this slide relative to wet mount versus Aptima. This is a paper by Eric Munson published last year where he looked at outpatient, emergency, and urgent care facilities. And this just shows you the variety of how people performed wet mount. I really wonder in some of these if they weren't just looking at something shaking around and that's what they called trichomonas. But basically, it was statistically significant that the NAT Aptima test detected over wet mount, almost 50%. Comparisons to some other studies, wet mount, culture, the antigen test, and Aptima, again, it's clear that the detection rate goes up higher and higher with each method that doesn't rely on something that needs to be done quickly. And actually, this is a significant part of this paper by Huppert et al. That shows that when you look at whether somebody has symptoms or does not have symptoms, that the wet mount performed even worse, so 38% versus 57%. The culture stayed pretty steady at about 70% sensitive, and the rapid test, again, because it's only approved for symptomatic patients, expectedly did very poor, 62% versus 92%, and the amplification did equally across the board. So culture and amplification were not affected whether somebody was symptomatic or not symptomatic, but the rapid test and wet mount did. And I think that because there are so many people that are asymptomatic that are carrying this organism, again, we need to be more secure in the detection method that we're going to use. This is just, again, by Nye, showing the same thing. So we see this consistent increase in sensitivity of these test methods, and these are both of them together. And what's great about this, it just shows that you're dead on consistency across the board with the methods compared to amplification. And, you know, this is really where we want to be. This is what we're doing most commonly. This is where we want to be. So we're missing about half of the Trichomonas infections. This is our data in a low prevalence site. And again, this is culture that we are currently doing in the women's correctional facility in Rhode Island. They routinely do culture, and so we're doing NAT on those same patients. And right now, at this point, we're finding that their culture sensitivity is only about 55%. This AFFIRM comparison is based on women who are getting a GC chlamydia specimen as well as an AFFIRM test submitted. So I'm assuming that they're symptomatic, but that's only about 8% of my overall population. So women that are getting an AFFIRM test and Trichomonas gardnerella candida are not commonly getting a GC chlamydia test at the same time. But for that group that does, we are seeing the AFFIRM to be about 66% sensitive for Trichomonas relative to NAT. This is a poster, it's actually up on the board today. This is in HIV patients that are in a continuously monitoring program, the SUN study. And as Charlotte showed, there is persistence of infection. What's interesting about this group is we compared it to PCR was routinely being done by a vaginal swab. We were looking at the NAT from urines that were routinely being collected, and we actually got a better sensitivity for Trichomonas from a urine than we did from the vaginal swab being done by PCR, which is pretty consistent. PCR has been shown to be about 80-85% sensitive, and the Aptima about, you know, that much more. But what was interesting with this is that the persistence of Trichomonas, which is not reportable, partners don't get treated. The women got treated initially, their partners didn't, that they persist with the infection over the baseline of normal prevalence in the population. So it's clear that in a group where they're getting treated, reported, their partners are getting treated, their chlamydia GC rate is negligible, but their Trichomonas rate continues to be off the wall. Okay, so compared to other methods, the Aptima has outperformed all other methods regardless of specimen type. Or test method. Easy to collect if you're using Aptima now, a swab or a urine actually works very well. And there are no transport issues. And you can use the same container. In our low prevalence population, we found that TV was more prevalent than either GC or chlamydia when we combined all patient groups. So, you know, I actually do a presentation for our medical staff next week to say, okay, we really need to start thinking about this more routinely. And you know, the question I have is why is Aptima more sensitive than PCR, but this has been shown now in a number of studies. And you know, people, because it's a research use only when you're using PCR, they may use a different methodology of how they're extracting, whatever. But target capture, which is used in Aptima, has really allowed you to look at places which have mixed flora very readily. So for instance, when we use rectal swabs or pharyngeal swabs, for other, the GC chlamydia and MSM and HIV patients, we have no issues with cross-contamination. Okay, so finally, the last thing I'd like to just mention is, you know, it's always a concerted effort to try to implement testing for a new organism, and it really is gonna provide public health, healthcare providers, the labs, and the patient, actually I think is a key component in this, much like the patient was a key component in HPV testing. And so we really need to get Trich on the map for the healthcare providers, you know, because we don't really know, they don't know the prevalence of the sequelae very well. It's not always associated with symptoms or necessarily with certain sexual risk behaviors. And again, that older age group may be something unique that they really need to look at. And educate the public. Did you know the most common treatable STI is one that your physician may not be testing for? I mean, that could be really the hooker to get, you know, women saying, hey, what's going on here? And then educate the laboratory, because a lot of times the lab is just as overwhelmed as every other component of healthcare, and they're just gonna do whatever's easiest for them, and, you know, maybe not try and implement something new as well. The next thing is we really need to get an FDA-cleared test, because I have implemented 25 molecular platforms over the last 5 years in my lab, and it's a lot easier to do it if it's FDA-cleared test, especially with all the things that CAP now requires for us to do on limit of detection studies and quality assurance. It's really a nightmare to implement a non-FDA-cleared molecular test. What I plan on doing is combining it with GC chlamydia in the box, you know, like GC chlamydia trick, you know, check it off, just make it there, make it available. And also try and encourage physicians to say, you know, I know you're used to doing a rapid wet mount, but if it's only 50% sensitive, maybe what you can do is get into the mindset of, well, you're used to getting GC and chlamydia the next day or that afternoon. How about if we just get used to the idea that trick is going to come at the same time with the GC chlamydia? We actually may improve the workflow in our lab if we're only going to do this testing once a day versus multiple times that we're looking at these smears. The cost and reimbursement may be better, so if I'm looking at implementing something more expensive, I do have to look and see what my reimbursement might be. There's always all these budget games that you play. But in the end, what I always say to my lab administrator, who, when she says, how much does it cost, her only concern is how much of the reagents that you're using. I'm always looking at the bigger picture. Well, how much HIV may we not be spreading back and forth, or how many premature rupture of membranes and low birth babies may we be preventing. So in the end, it's always about what's the best test for better patient care as well. And that's how I get most of my stuff through that costs more money. The third thing really is public health. We have to make this a reportable disease in order for us to really be able to move forward. We need testing guidelines that say this is when we need to test and who we need to test, as opposed to, well, if they're symptomatic, throw it on top of everything else. And really, that will allow us to do treatment of partners. And be able to test partners potentially. So for instance, I went to our public health lab in Rhode Island, which is small. The state's small enough you can spit across it. So the one good thing about that is that we have one office of public health. And I went to them to say, okay, is there a way that we can collaborate to try and start doing something with trichomonas? And what I suggested to them is, I do about 50% of the testing in all of Rhode Island at Lifespan. That's a huge hospital system that has a huge amount of outreach. And the public health lab probably does the other 50%. So I said, all right, let's get a handle on what we're really seeing in Rhode Island. How about if I test all your urines or your endocervical swabs or anything that you have for a period of time, and let's just see how much trichomonas we have, just so you can feel comfortable about what we have. And, you know, try and get some collaborations going that way. Well, the diagnostic end of the public health lab was like, oh, no problem. We'll de-identify the specimens. If you're going to test them, that's no work for us. But the epidemiological end of the public health lab was not so enthusiastic, because they're like, oh, God, it's another thing we have to report. And so I understand that, you know, no one wants more work, but I think we really can't be sticking our head in the sand like an ostrich anymore related to this. It's really not a good excuse. So I'm kind of saying, let's look at the glass as half full. It's an opportunity for us to move forward, you know, if we get some collaborations and figure out what's going on. STD clinics, again, I would say get the providers off the track of the quick and cheap to using the same protocol that they're using for GC chlamydia. Because amplification is more sensitive. And then I really think that we need to get obstetrics and gynecology collaborations going, because there is this thought that, well, you know, unless a woman's symptomatic for trich and we treat them, we don't really need to treat the asymptomatic groups. I don't think the studies that were done, the one Klebanoff study that was published in New England Journal of Medicine, did not use amplification, they used culture. I think some of the statistics done from that is a little questionable, but when I go to any of the OBGYNs, that's the first article they cite, that I don't want to be testing asymptomatic women and then treating them, because it actually was worse for premature rupture of membranes. So we really need to look at some of those studies as well. And I guess I would just say that the screening, the time is now, so we can stop the revolving door of infections, because right now it not being reportable, the partners are not getting treated, and whether men, when they're tested, are positive or not, we clearly are seeing these women persistent with this infection for a very long time. Okay? And at that point, I'll end my presentation, and if anyone has questions for Charlotte, myself, we'd be happy to take them. Again, the GenPro booth will have information if you have any questions as well, and these are being recorded so that you can refer to them if you have any questions. So, anyone?
Question.
Yes.
One of the things that you're discussing is anything that was either in the media. And there indeed is enough, probably in the population, that I have from us in the younger language to apply to justify the toy that I wanted to ask. But if you're only going to be screening young women, you're going to be missing most screening tests perfectionally. And also, if you're using the trivalent aspect in older women, there's going to be all these women who don't know how to address the community.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I was really surprised to see that bump, and I have a very untactful joke that I, because we're using the tigress, I'm like, ooh, the tigress is detecting cougars. So I don't know if that's part of it. But one of the things that was interesting, when we actually started using amplification for GC and chlamydia, we got this bump at 30. And people were like really surprised, like, ooh, what's that bump at 30? And I'm like, I'm not surprised. A lot of women are getting tested for the first time for chlamydia, the first time they get pregnant. And so I really think that was one of the reasons we saw that bump. I think a lot of these women probably weren't getting screened earlier. And you're absolutely right. How are we going to pair that? Well, maybe we pair it with HPV testing when they get their cervical screening. And the fact that this can be available through ThinPrep may be the answer to that. I think it's just one of those things where, again, taking a sexual history for a lot of physicians is very difficult. And you have a woman that's in a relationship and she's married, or maybe she's not married, whatever, that discussion has to be brought up. So that's a huge issue for healthcare providers, is understanding that difference in prevalence. So.
Yeah, that's great. I agree with Kim. And I think one of the things is we really don't have good national data. Everything that we have has been done retrospectively. And so we really don't know how much trick there is in the young if you would look with an amplified test. So I think until we get some data, and then from the data make some guidelines, and maybe we want to do chlamydia and gonorrhea more focused in the younger age group, but certainly if they have trick, they should be treated, and if it's easy to look for it. But also pairing it with the HPV, with the older age group, and maybe there's a group in the middle that needs all four. So, but until we have the data, it's going to be really hard to make any recommendations. And I think the data will change once we get data from amplified testing. There's no advocacy group that I know of, except maybe Kim. We're a group of two. I think there should be. I mean, we just recently got a chlamydia, National Chlamydia Coalition. Jill's in the group too.
Yeah.
Group of three.
So, and just so you know too, when I went to the public health lab, again, the diagnostic end was happy to do it. And the epidemiology end said, well, it's not reportable. I'm like, yes, but you have the choice state to state to decide whether you want to make it reportable, actually. And so I said, why not be the first ones to make it reportable? And again, it ended up coming down to resources. So, yes. Jill, yeah. I know, I did see you in the audience. I'm like, okay, you can correct me. Yes. Yeah.
Anything is better than
that.
Yep. Yep.
Hi, Harold Weiser. There's the nose of the bigger advocate of that testing myself.
I'll add that bubble. Thank you. That's the square. But if they're getting chlamydia GC now, and again, depending on what population they're in, so it's really to hook it to that group. Well, we haven't had a problem with reimbursement at this point with it, actually. That has not been an issue for us.
There are many things that need to be done. CPT codes, right.
Yeah,
David's in the back. We do need more trials. I mean, they're just selective small studies. Well, some of them are pretty good-sized studies, but it's something to be aware of, and we do probably need more trials to show if treating TRIC does prevent adverse birth outcomes and does prevent HIV acquisition. These are very expensive to do, as you know, but until we have good diagnostics, they're also going to be imperfect. So I think the two have to go hand in hand. It's just... there's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah.
You know, the first time I remember the state had so
I've never seen any data to that. Maybe it's a hypothesis. Jill's the director of the training center in Cincinnati. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe a hypothesis.
I don't know about the Barclays, but I think Steve Peterman has a wonderful lady. You can have a
I did, yeah.
And I think
Jerry Comhoff,
I know maybe the problem is if you don't use the diagnostic method, and a lot
that's
of
a problem.
Yes.
It's a fabulous
yes.
And it's all just
yeah.
Last question, I think we have to end.
Next year?
I don't know.
Maybe, it's 2011.
2011?
Right? We're in clinical trial. We're in clinical trials right now, so the clinical trials are ongoing.
For.
Oh, no, no. Well, before 2012, Jill. So the clinical trials are ongoing now. I'm one of the testing sites. I don't know if Charlotte, if Charlotte is. So, and I know that that's going to be done over a 3 to 6 month period, and then, you know, it gets submitted to FDA, and then who knows. But there are many labs that, because they have a Tigris or a DTS, they have self-validated these in their labs, so because the reagents are available. So,
yeah, it's possible if you do a verification assay that you can, you know, can be used before the trials are done. Thank you all for coming and for the lively discussion.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.